Make no mistake, if you're an author, you're an entrepreneur. You're selling the world on your book, aren't you? Of course, it's not as easy as launching a business and then tossing any old book up on Amazon. That's why I help entrepreneurs publish books on the specific topic and in the specific way that will launch or grow their businesses. Welcome to Entrepreneur Publishing Academy with your professor, Anna David. Hi there. What's up, entrepreneurs? This is Entrepreneur Publishing Academy with your host and professor, Anna David. You know what we do? We talk to entrepreneurs and best-selling authors about how to build a business with your book. And brought to you by Book Elevator Pitch, if you want to know what that is. If you are writing a nonfiction book, you need a Book Elevator Pitch. I've already told you that in this show. But go to bookelevatorpitch.com to grab it. And today's guest is an expert in all things newsletters. Now, newsletters are one of these things that when I say to a new author, you need a newsletter list, I see something between sheer panic and just sheer boredom, like the bizarre combination sort of cross their face. Well, it's the truth. You need to start one. And my guest today gives you very actionable tips on how to do it. We talked about the best newsletter provider to start with, average open rates, why to be vulnerable in your emails, how and why to split test, whether or not you should resend emails to subscribers who don't open, and so much more. Her name? You want to know her name. Her name is Holly Darling. Isn't that cute? Holly Darling. She's the owner of Holly Darling HQ, a business that focuses on helping authors create and implement their email marketing strategies. And she is also an author. So grab the show notes by going to legacylaunchpadpub.com/blog/Holly, H-O-L-L-Y. And now I give you Holly Darling. So here we go. Thanks for being here, Holly.
Thanks for having me, Anna.
So let us talk about newsletter lists, how they are. I just had Jane Friedman on the podcast. She said it's the number one thing authors need. I would say anecdotally, it's the number one thing authors are reticent to start doing. You are an expert. What do you think?
Well, it always strikes me as funny when authors are hesitant to write newsletters until I remember the reasons that I've gathered over the years. But yeah, I think that newsletters are the best, single best way to build brand loyalty, create conversions, get data from, data to drive new business making decisions, just to basically connect with your readers, regardless of the genre that you write, regardless of how many books you have written or are thinking of writing. Newsletters are data that you own, but also we're storytellers by nature. If you're writing a book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, we can talk and we can talk with words. So why not use that medium, right?
Yeah, I do think it's looking at it as another creative outlet rather than, oh my God, this thing I have to do.
Yeah, it's an extension of your voice, and once I work with authors and they kind of see that the vulnerability piece, which is usually what's, one of the things, like, I don't want somebody to unsubscribe that feels, or it feels icky if I'm selling, or all these things. When we create strategies that just eliminate those, it really is fun, and you can get right into it as an extension of who you are and what you want to teach people or entertain people with or anything like that.
Okay. So the number one question, how do you start? How do you get those first subscribers?
Yeah. The unfortunate reality of first subscribers is always, it's friends and family to start with before anybody really kind of knows you as far as who do you ask. But even before that, I always say there's a conscious decision. And for me, it's in a plan. For others, it's got to be something they decide, whether they're going to make social media their hub, I call it their hub, or their list their hub. And I am obviously in favor of making your list your hub. And that just makes it easy for all conversations, whether marketing or one-to-one or however that looks like, and speaking engagements, come to my website, join my list. And you're just moving all things in that direction. Then it's not hard to remember to do that, right? Like, oh, well, I have a Facebook page and I have an Instagram page and I have a list. It gets lost, you know, but lists are data that you own. And if you think about that conversion in not just in terms of revenue, but in terms of the ability to connect with somebody with a traceable, you know, footprint, lists being the first point of entry to your, you know, to your brand is always a good idea. However, yeah, when you're first starting, it's completely intimidating and terrifying. There's the technical stuff and then there's the marketing piece, right? So getting started without any followers, you have to A, be comfortable with having 10 people on your list for a little while and thinking of it as a marketing experiment, you know, like, well, I'm going to take these 10 people and I'm going to test a lot of theories out on them, you know, or I'm going to try some stuff and see what works. But then there are different ways that you can grow those 10 to 20 and so on and so on. And some ways are easier than others. They would be lead magnets, you know, so you could create something that holds value for your readers. And in fiction, that can be, you know, short stories, previews, downloadables. In nonfiction, it's easy. I think it's easier. It's downloadables or it's educational content. But my one piece of advice is to start now, whether you're published or not. And that way you're spending some time, yes, getting data and testing things, but also building that brand loyalty. And those people will become like, you know, in the fiction world, they can become ARC readers. So advanced reader copies, and they are the ones that will be your sales team. You know, because they have grown with you. And if you are brave and vulnerable and talk about that journey with them, they're rooting for you and they'll reply to you and ask you if they can help. And that small little group of people that you start with can become invaluable. So those small numbers that feel insignificant and feel sometimes embarrassing, like, oh, I only have 100 people on my list. Oh my gosh, those are the times that you can do so much with those 100 people, as opposed to having 50,000 and you have a whole new set of problems connecting with people. Yeah, I don't know if I answered your question.
I think that's really important. First of all, your open rates are going to be a million times better,
yes,
which is really the number that matters the most. And I think so many people lie about their numbers, because I cannot tell you how many people I talk to and I go, how big is your list? They're like, pretty small, like 10. And I'm like, oh, they mean 10 people, 10,000. I'm like, yeah, I don't believe you. People are lying. We don't know. I think
we don't, but it's like that vanity metric, right? That people are like, well, if I say I only have 1,000, they'll think I'm less than, yeah, you know, less of an author or less of a speaker or what have you. But I mean, I've had 10,000 and I have reduced that list to 2,000 and then regrown again and then gone back to that, because it's all about the quality of your list, not the quantity of your list.
100%. So what would you say is a good open rate? I know it depends on the number of people on your list, but what do you say?
Yeah, so it does depend on a whole bunch of things. But if you're looking at across the board averages, I would say like averages are somewhere between 20 and 22. Now they feel like more like 30 to 45 with, you know, somewhat inflated open rates due to the Apple privacy policy. But different industries have higher rates. The entertainment industry has a higher rate, open rate. You know, food and accommodation has a higher open rate. It just really depends on, you know, the audience that you're reaching. But I mean, most people that I work with land realistically, and I say that because of the inflation that is, you know, being seen now since September, you know, somewhere between 25 and 35 is kind of where most people sit. But again, thinking about the click rate that goes along with it. So the open rate is like first, you know, first point of entry, important metric to kind of keep an eye on. And then once you start to have something to kind of offer them, or you have a call to action, that click rate becomes very important as well. So where do they both kind of average out? But yeah, people get upset. You know, I have an open rate of 15%. I'm like, okay, so let's figure out why and what happened. Maybe you have you've sent an email to everybody on your list that typically, if you have larger lists, that will give you a lower open rate, but it's not the end of the world. It's just data, right?
And exactly. What would you say? This is what I've sort of observed in the last couple of years, is it feels like people got burned out on lead magnets. And a lot of times I can also say anecdotally myself, I'm more likely to sign up because they describe what's in the newsletter and that looks interesting to me. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I think the lead magnet has to solve a problem. It has to be communicated clearly, but just assuming that having something free, having the word free in there is going to convert into, a registration is a recipe for not getting a great conversion rate. I think clarity is what sells, and especially in the nonfiction space, people have turned up, it just kind of goes right by their eyes. Like that word free is either, feels like spam, or it feels like, yeah, whatever. They really need to connect with you, right? And that's what it's all about. And inside of the newsletter, I think needs to follow up with that connection, but also needs to deliver that, more importantly than the downloadable, because I can count maybe on one hand how many times I've actually used the downloadable that, I've gone somewhere to get it. But I've thought that downloadable would solve a problem, but in reality, it's the person delivering it and the value that they send in the newsletter to follow up with that. It really has no bearing on whether I continue to subscribe or unsubscribe. So lead magnets, I think, are due a bit of a change, as far as what they are and how they work. But again, it's all about testing, right? If you see that you're not getting those conversions, then try something different. Lead magnets don't always equal people signing up for your list.
Yeah. One thing I'm doing now is I have one page that's just, this is what is in this best-selling book bulletin. And one that is, here is how you do an elevator pitch. You'll get this download. Just to see, have one actionable and one just promote. They both attract people. But I found with a lead magnet, actionable. Give somebody so they can do something that where they get a quick win. You want the dopamine rise from your.
Yeah, lead exactly. Magnet. I like video. I like something where they can see your face, where they can make that trust decision, or something they don't have to print out because they're like. A lot of people don't have printers. A lot of people don't, these things. But yeah, what can you give them that actually moves them forward in the journey and the reason why they came to you in the first place? Don't make them do more work. Make it easy, but also make it clear.
Yeah. So nurture sequence is another thing that I have somewhat abandoned because I got so sick of them from other people. Six things that all follow the same format. I do like two or one. Where do you stand on the nurture sequence? And explain what a nurture sequence is.
Yeah, so a nurture sequence is just the follow-up email or series of emails that come to your subscriber after they have joined your list. I love a nurture sequence, but I don't love a random nurture sequence that just pushes things down, buy this. In the author space, in the fiction, it's like, buy my book. In nonfiction, it's, you need to do this and buy my course and do this and buy my course and do this and buy my program or what have you. It feels inauthentic. It doesn't also have to be any more than one email. And it can be a lot of emails. It really depends, but I think one mistake a lot of people make when they do add a nurture sequence into their newsletter system is that they're sending that sequence and it has a decent amount of emails and they're set 24 hours apart or something. And then they're also sending, you know, weekly newsletters or maybe twice a week newsletters to people. This happens a lot in the nonfiction space where you're trying to help somebody with your regular newsletter and they're going through your nurture sequence. And then they're getting two or three emails a week and they're like, whoa, like too much. And sometimes they're landing boom, boom, right after each other. And it just doesn't, it's not conducive to getting anything opened because people got like, okay,
I'm not going to do this.
Yeah. So
Kajabi and Drip allow you to not, they don't get your weekly until they're through the nurture. So yeah, that is something.
That's good. And all other places you can get that set up, but it takes like remembering to manually exclude, you know, put them in a group and then exclude them or tag them or whatever, but it's totally doable. But 9 times out of 10 is not done. So back to how long they could be. It depends. If you are an author with a backlist, you can make it a bit longer, but I say spread the time out between those emails and make it intentional. Like my word in 2022 for emails is customization. And that doesn't mean that everybody gets their own email, but based on their actions, so things they've clicked or done, send them something that really means something to them, that's valuable to them. You know, in the fiction space, maybe it's a trope or a theme that comes along that, you know, they said, oh yeah, I really love political thrillers. Then you can set a sequence up to kind of deliver them your political thrillers. If you have nothing to offer them, like you're just kind of new and you're starting out, and a welcome sequence can be one email, like, thanks for signing up. I would love a video, at least so they can kind of get to know you. And tell them what to expect. Like, I send weekly emails or I send them every month or whatever, so that they're not like, what the heck is happening? You know, like, who is this person? Remind them how they got there, why they're there, and what they're going to get from that point forward, and then stick to that. Don't slide into, you know, one way or the other, never emailing them or emailing them all the time.
I'm taking notes because you're giving me so many great ideas. A video as part of that sequence. You know, I just signed up for Bonjouro and I had this day where I'm like, I'm going to send a video, personal video, to everyone who subscribes. And then I realized that's absolutely impossible, but would be cool. It looks like their free plan allows, you know, if you're new to and you don't have that many people subscribing every day, that seems like a good service.
Exactly. That's something, again, that you can do with a small list, you know, where you're like, okay, I can do this. Or you can just film a blanket general video. Hey, I'm Holly. Thanks for joining, you know, whatever. And it's pretty generalized, but that custom piece, you can fool around with that and then see if that, did you get any response? And people will typically reply to that. And if you get nothing, then you're like, okay, well, that's not worth it to continue on. Maybe I'll try something else. But thinking again, people are reading these on mobile, they're in a hurry. What are your own feelings about emails in your inbox? And typically you can start with a small list, assuming that the people joining have similar feelings, maybe not the exact same, but they might be overwhelmed or reading in a hurry, only want short emails, don't want something that goes on and on and on forever. Don't have the time to upload a video. So you got to make sure that upload time is good. All these things, when you're trying to make a decision, I always say head to your own inbox and see what's happening there and what you like and what you don't like. Try to use that for inspiration.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, except like something like, I hate emojis in newsletters. I don't know why. I think it's some weird OCD thing. I see it and it gets upsetting to me on the subject line. However, I hear emojis are great in a subject line. What about little tricks like that?
Yeah, I don't use emojis very often. But same thing, funny enough, when I see one, it stops me, right? So depends. Overuse of anything tends to not be a great idea. So you could split test it. And so you have one subject line for part of your list and another, the same email, and give them a different subject line. And it's easy sometimes as one subject line and one with an emoji, and see if one of them gets opened more often than the other, and you have your answer, whether you dislike them or not. And then I would say use them sporadically, right? Only for emails that are super important that you can get a call to action going that equals revenue, typically is when I will pull out some of the big stops, you know. But subject lines are a whole workshop in and of themselves. But thinking along the lines of, you know, there are things that are you shouldn't put in subject lines, like that will have you flagged as spam right away, such as the word free, lots of exclamation marks, really long subject lines, things that use the word you, like, hey, you, those kinds of things. There's, and the words change all the time and it's really impossible to keep track of them. But there are, those are some of the key things that typically will get you sent right into the spam folder, especially as a new author who hasn't really got their deliverability rates kind of up and running. My biggest thing with subject lines is keeping a subject line file of those that you like inside your inbox. Oh, that was cool. I like that. File it for inspiration. Try to figure out a way to use it that works for your brand. Don't overuse emojis, punctuation, capitalization, but try things that aren't really being done. Like I've got, you know, President Obama once sent an email that just said, hey, and I'm like, well, that was weird, you know, but I opened it and like, well, so then I started experimenting with, hey, and it works, but again, not overusing it and thinking about if I was sending an email to a friend, what would my subject line be? And I struggle with subject lines to friends all the time, especially I don't want to like open this up, you know, or whatever. But then sometimes I'm like, well, maybe I'll use that for, you know, for my newsletter. Open this up. Or if you can ask them a leading question too, it'll often work. Like, I can't believe this happened. Or did you see the news? Like anything that kind of is the question that leaves them hanging, like, well, no, I want to know what that is, you know. And those are often really good as in a plain sentence structure. Some people like to use all lowercase. It feels very friendly, you know, like, oh, if I'm sending something to a friend, I tend not to capitalize and punctuate, you know, that it feels friendly. You can use personalization. I don't often use it, but some experts swear by it, where you insert their first name into the email. But again, all of these things are things you can try. I highly recommend, most email service providers offer you the ability to A/B test your subject lines. So you can put a couple in, let it run for a couple hours and see what happens.
That's great. Do you recommend resending to people who don't open a couple days later?
It depends. I'll do that only for what I call revenue generating emails. So if there's a call to action in there that I really want things to happen, like your book launch, or you've got a pre-order app, or you're appearing somewhere where there's ticket sales, or there's something happening that you can visibly track an ROI on the click that happens there, I'll resend on opens with the knowledge that open rate again is often, 20% of it is often non-reliable because it's come from an iOS user where they're flagged as open no matter what. So it's hard to know if they really have opened it. And then sometimes they'll get duplicates if they haven't opened it. But again, a way around that is just make sure it's a completely different subject line.
Yeah.
And even go so far as to change like the top line, entry line, the salutation or something inside the email. And then if they do happen to open both, there's a bit of a different feel there. And they're not seeing that them stack up in their inbox where they're like, I know some authors that consistently do this with every single email. And now they've trained me to like not open the first email because I know it'll come again. Right. And you don't want to do that. So yeah, I think they're important, but I don't think they're use it every email important.
Yeah. And in terms of deliverability, do you think on the original email, the first one saying, hey, write me back with blah-de-de-blah so that you're training their inbox to not ever recognize it as spam. Do you think that's important?
It is important, but it's really hard to get that call to action to happen. So the response and then your response again is kind of closing the loop, is ultimately kind of a gold star in deliverability. However, it's hard to happen. So sometimes I'll put a block, a button in. And instead of a link behind the button, I'll use the code mail2:, and then my email address. And then if they click that button, it automatically brings up their email sending outbox and it auto fills your email address in there. And you can even write some more code if you wanted to that has a subject line ready for them and all that. So if making it really easy, but also kind of leading them right to that button that you would like,
great.
It works well.
I love it. So in terms of, you said early on, sort of pick your lane. Are you going to do social media? Or are you going to do newsletters? What if you want to do both?
Yeah, I do both. But everybody that knows me over on my social channels knows that if they want to get more information, they need to be on the list. So it's a constant conversation that's being had over on social media. Let's say, like, for instance, on Facebook, it would be, you know, the button goes to a landing page to join the list. The lead magnet offer is there. If it's on TikTok, the link is heading to a landing page where they can join. You know, those are intentional pathways that I've set up. Mm-hmm. And you know, every so many social media posts is, are you on the list? Today they got this lesson, you know, or in my fictional, I'm also a fictional author. So in that, it's, you know, join my list to get this book free, you know, to read this book free is in the rotation, you know, and it's not every day, but it is there. And on pinned posts, there's join the list, click this link, get the lead magnet, blah, blah, blah. So, mm-hmm.
And yeah. Instagram now allows pinned posts.
You know, yes. So it's part of the conversation. My link in bio is definitely to a landing page to get a downloadable. It's just part of my intention. I don't think you need to do one or the other. I think they can complement each other. However, I think lists are much more effective at selling and socials are much more effective or as effective at educating.
Oh God, I had an important question, but then I got distracted by this. Here's my important question. Do you think if you're going to do one link, it's more important to get them on your list or to get them to your book?
List, because you can continue to sell to them as your backlist grows, as you write more things, as you make appearances. I'm a big fan of getting them on the list. The first email in a welcome sequence can do some work at, like, you know, if you want to purchase the book, here it is, blah, blah, blah. But then like conversion rates on lists are in the 20 to 30% range on average, where conversion rates on social media, when you want to sell them something, you know, are like typically less than 1% with the outliers that have, you know, kind of gone there. It's just such a more reliable space where you own the process, you own the visibility, and you own what happens after. So
what if, in terms of live appearances, do you recommend, you know, sort of having a place where they can physically write down their names and email addresses, or is there a better way to do that?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely would. Or you can use technology and you can have something pre-planned. You know, when I do speaking events, I've got they have their own little landing page. It depends on how the conference is set up. You know, for that, if you're at a conference, you know, then usually the organizers have some sort of tech delivery, you know, going on during speaking events, like, here's the slides, here is a coupon code, here is how to join your list. When I'm doing like book signings or things like that live, I usually would have an iPad, you know, there with the landing page. Then it's totally, I know I'm legal. I know I've got everything kind of working, but you can do a very standard pen, paper, as long as you get the right pieces of information and the consent that you need. I don't think you should be without an ask to a list, regardless of where you're at.
Yeah. Even the grocery store, even Starbucks.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic. Is there anything I haven't asked you about email lists that you'd love to share? Oh, what about putting a sign up in your book? Always? And oh, do you yeah. put it in the front?
I have it in both front and back. Not everybody does. The reason I do, so I have it in the front, different offer, different landing page. And I'm like, oh, wow, you love my book so much. You signed up for my list before you even read it. You know,
oh, I love it.
That's just in case they never get back to the rest of the book. And then I have it right after the end. And I know that sometimes there's preview stamp chapters. Sometimes there's this, that, and the other thing, but again, thinking that that's my hub, that's where I want everybody to go. I will move them onto my list, right away at the end, at the back matter. And it also, tracks that. I've tracked that in the list and I track their behaviors, but they also get a little special something for having read the whole book and then joining the list. So I can see where they came in as well. It's important.
I love it. I love it. And of course, with nonfiction, it can definitely be get the glossary, get the cheat sheets, whatever it is that will enhance their experience of having read the book.
Yeah. As long as it connects to what they've just read, there's typically a really great pickup on that bonus content. Mm-hmm.
In terms of, do you think MailChimp is the easiest one to start with?
MailChimp feels like it's the easiest one to start with because they've done a really great job at marketing and making that name synonymous with email marketing. However, they have some, in the past few years, there have been some changes at MailChimp that I think don't make them the best choice for brand new authors. I know that MailerLite has a free service under 1,000 subscribers. And the big difference between them, especially for new to email lists, is the service. With MailChimp, when you're at the free space, you don't get any customer service or assistance. With something, with a program like MailerLite, they do offer all the customer service you need with their free program under 1,000 and all the full automations, full everything. Wow. And with the exception of a few templates, but you get to use them for a couple of weeks. Where with MailChimp, you got to really start to upgrade if you want to talk to anybody and get more than the basic stuff that's there. As far as integrations go, like how they integrate nicely with websites, MailChimp typically integrates with a lot of those templated websites easily, but all email service providers can do that. Just takes a few extra steps.
If I can say anything useful today, it's avoid drip at all costs. I nearly had 17 breakdowns during the brief time I was using drip. I don't know if you have experience with that
one. I've used them once for a client work that I was doing, but I've never personally used them.
Mon Dieu. Sorry, one more thing I just remembered. You sort of touched on this, but while working on a book, do you think absolutely share at, hey guys, I just started on my new book. Hey, I'm on chapter 3, really bringing them into the process so that they're invested.
100%. I haven't released a book in like a year and a half, which is abnormal, but pandemic, all those kinds of things, right? But I have not stopped sending newsletters. And I just typed the end on one and sent a book off to the editor and wrote a newsletter. And I've been getting replies all morning like, oh my gosh, you're back. Yay. Congratulations. It doesn't have to be weekly updates, but I think it should be consistent updates. Like, here's where I'm at. This is, and you're getting them excited. You're getting them invested in your success. And again, when you're ready to tell them, go buy the book, they are ready to buy the book, as opposed to trying to build that list in those critical times when a book comes out is when you can get the most organic lift from anything, right? And you want to have your list start to push that, a little bit.
Okay. I love it. Now, is there anything that I've neglected to ask you that would be useful for listeners?
I don't think so. I think the biggest thing that I could say is just do it now. Don't wait, do it now. And stay consistent. If you choose to write a newsletter and you pick, I'm going to pick Tuesdays, first Tuesday of every month, a monthly newsletter, great. Stay consistent. Because all these changes that you make and like, I have nothing to write about. You probably always do have something, you just aren't sure if it's going to work or not, just do it. But it messes with your deliverability if you keep changing things. So stay consistent, but do it. Just start doing it.
And We should mention you help authors do this. So what if someone listening wants to find out more information about that?
Sure. You can hang out with me. My website is hollydarlinghq.com, and there's lots of free stuff there, free little mini courses, a blog, and you can join my Facebook group where we talk emails every single day. And we do lots of that, or you can take a course. They're very non-genre specific. Just there are specific courses, and then there are general email courses, or you can just ask me to help you with your email strategy, which I do quite a bit.
I love it. I'll put those links in the show notes. So thank you so much, Holly. This was so informative. So many action steps I know I'm going to take. So I imagine you all will too. So thanks so much for being here.
And, thanks for having me.
And you guys, thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks for joining me this week on Entrepreneur Publishing Academy with Anna David. For more info about the show, go to entrepreneurpublishing.academy, where you can get links to show notes and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google, and all the other places. Speaking of those places, if you got anything out of this show, I can't tell you how much I'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. And please don't forget you can tell an author or entrepreneur friend about the show. Another forget-me-not, my company Legacy Launchpad Publishing is available to help industry leaders and those with stories to share at any stage in their publishing journeys, whether that's writing, editing, or publishing. Just go to legacylaunchpadpub.com to find out more. And be sure to tune in next week for next week's episode. You know, if you subscribe, you never have to worry about missing one.